Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I'm now here with Charlemagne, who is, well, I'm not given his notes. I'm not sure whether to describe him as a neo-reactionary anymore. That might be, that was how I saw you last year. But Charlemagne, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I am Charlemagne. I am well known for sort of popularizing neo-reaction or the dark enlightenment on YouTube by making a series of videos on Mencius Moldbug. I have recently called myself a neo-reactionary, but I would not use that term anymore. I like Panama Hat's formulation of authentic reactionary. I think maybe the one of the deep ironies is that my avatar, Charlemagne, actually basically aligns one-to-one with my current political opinions. So there's that. I mean, I still find a lot of value in Mencius Moldbug's writings and to some extent Curtis Yarvin's as well. But I definitely would not apply the neo-reactionary label to myself anymore, mostly because what neo-reaction is about, it's really about secure, responsible, and effective government, which is basically technocracy. I mean, what Moldbug ultimately wants is sort of liberal technocracy, sort of an Elon Musk-style government, and certainly effective or responsible government would be an improvement from what we have. But, I don't think this is something the dissident right really has in mind when it comes to the type of political formulation we would like to live in. So I think myself and many other people in my spheres have sort of moved past that label. I'm not even sure there are any actual neo-reactionaries left in our spheres, to be honest.
Well, we can get onto that later on. It's an interesting development for sure. Now, you did appear last year on Millennial. People can seek that out. Just go to the Millennial website and you'll find it there. Let's go to the notes. Now, you've got three sections here, three things that you want to talk about. And the first relates to the state of things post-COVID. Not that we are exactly post-COVID yet, but the state of things that has emerged as a result of that, or would you say that it has already emerged even before that. But either way, would you like to take it away?
Sure. I would say it's been revealed to us, which is sort of one of the reasons I haven't really been making a lot of videos this year, is because I'm sort of at a loss of what to even talk about in terms of political analysis at this point, because everything is just laid so bare in front of us at this point. There's almost no commentary I could add to it that is of any value. And, what I mean by this is effectively liberal totalitarianism revealing itself in terms of the fortification of the election, even the fact that Joe Biden managed to win the primaries in the first place, and then, of course, the biomedical security state we now find ourselves in. So this has sort of been, I think it's sort of an ultimate consolidation of the liberal victory over the entire West that actually happened many decades ago. And I think this is what a lot of us are realizing for the first time, that our predecessors in right-wing politics failed to realize, is that we're sort of fighting for a lost cause, I suppose, in a way. Samuel T. Francis has this excellent phrase, beautiful losers. I kind of feel like people have this idea like we're fighting a war to save the West with our words. But the reality is that war was really won quite a while ago before we even got involved. And at this point, we're sort of just fully at the mercy of the regime. And in my notes, I analogize this to the victory, fittingly, of the United States in particular over Japan in 1945, which, as we know, was an unconditional surrender, a total victory over Japan. And yet Japan continued and continues to exist, at least for now, as a distinct nation. It hasn't simply been annihilated, right? And so I think on the right, we need to acknowledge the fact that this war against our long-standing culture and traditions was fought. Liberalism achieved total victory. And now we're simply finding ourselves in those ashes. And the question is not, how do we win this war, which is the mistake that the right wing has always made. The war is over, right? We're just living in the consequences. The question is, how do we win the next war? How do we come out of this with some sort of intact civilization at the end of it? Similar to, you know, the Roman Empire collapsed as well. But Western civilization continued on and something came out of it. Positive developments came out of it. And we can achieve the same thing, or at least our ancestors can, or sorry, our descendants can. And that's the mode we have to be in, is not that, you know, we're going to achieve political power or something like that. None of our ideas are ever going to achieve political power by all, unless some miracle happens, within our lifetimes, I would think. So this is the mindset we have to be on, this sort of long-term, how do we survive and be in a position to win the next battle as this totalitarian regime that has emerged inevitably collapses. And, you know, I don't want to be defeatist. We just need to acknowledge the reality of the absolute state we find ourselves in. Because if we continue to deny it and act like we're going to somehow, you know, vote some sort of based president or prime minister or cabinet or whatever into office and overthrow this thing, that's just not happening, right? So that's sort of my perspective right now. And I think people really need to fully ingest this idea. And now is the perfect time to do so. Because we are, the state is just going to do whatever it wants to us at this point. And hopefully that we can survive through that. Hopefully enough of us with the right ideas can survive through that for the next phase. You know, this is, again, the man among the ruins idea. We really are the men among the ruins at this point. And we need to stop fighting for lost causes. And I think, you know, Philosophy Cat, I think, had the first stream this year, and a lot of people got triggered by that, I think. But I feel like she was basically saying the same thing. And perhaps people didn't quite understand what she meant. But again, I analogize to the end of the Second World War. The Japanese were totally defeated, and yet they continue to exist. So acknowledging the scale of the defeat that our culture has suffered is not to say that we can't ever come back from this. It's just to stop trying to fight a lost war, a war that we never even took part in. You know, I think a lot of people come into the movement, as I did, and they're like, okay, you know, I'm young and full of energy, and I want to fight. I want to, you know, take it to the enemy and win. And they sort of get blinded by their own desire to do good and really fail to realize that it was their predecessors that were in this war already and lost it, right? So and we could actually take solace in that it's not like it's our fault as dissidents that this was lost. It was the people before us who failed to defeat the absolute takeover of liberalism of everything, right? So we can take solace in that.
Yeah, and I don't think they realize this. I mean, it's not just the people before us, it's the people multiple generations yes. before us. And I don't think they realize the scale of... I don't think they even realized they'd been beaten, actually. I don't think they realized what it meant to affirm equality. What it meant was Western civilization is now doomed. It's now just a dead man walking, basically. But... let's go into this first before we, obviously there's a lot that you've said there and let's unpack that because obviously it needs further study. So when was the last time that saving the West, the war that people talk about, which is saving the West or saving the European peoples as they were in 1900, 1800, the Swedish people, the German people, the Scottish people, etc. When was the last time that wasn't a lost cause?
Well, you know, I think Apostolic Majesty may have mentioned this, but putting a particular date as if like this is the line is almost a pointless exercise, but nevertheless, all throughout the year 1789 for you, and say that after 1789, after the French Revolution, the failure to halt that revolution and to stop the rise of Napoleon, I would say that is a good marker for, you know, where we ended up on this slippery slope at. I mean, with counterfactual history, I mean, anything could have happened, okay? Maybe the First World War could have worked out in some other way where we did recover from the rise of liberalism. But it doesn't actually do us much good to sort of, you know, have fantasies about what could have been. And what, the important thing is to recognize the trend. Yeah,
of course. But the reason I ask this question is to... It's so as to help people understand the situation today, to nail down the last point in time when this victory over the old world was secure, was like definitively secured. I think if people understand when it was definitively lost, that will help them to accept the loss.
I see. Definitively 1945. The period of 1789 to 1945 is the period of the rise of liberalism and the conquest of the West. And we can certainly say that definitively in 1945, there was no recovery. Every single place on the planet was conquered. And I mean that literally. The Soviet Union, communist, Eastern Europe, communist, all of Europe conquered and liberal. The United States, liberal, China, conquered, communist. There was nothing left at that point.
And Japan, of course, conquered Japan, yes. Western.
Right. So all of the major powers of the world were utterly conquered by Western liberalism in some form or another, or developments of it, like communism, at that point. And again, maybe we could say that in the late 40s, early 50s, there could have been some sort of reaction to this. In a political sense that could have reverted it. Again, we're sort of just getting into counterfactual history there, but to simplify it, 1945 is the point in time at which we sort of fell off the cliff, and now we're still falling off of it.
Yeah. So you say that we need to accept the state we are in, and not continue to deny it. Can you tell me the state we are in? First, and then I'll ask you about things, ways in which people deny it, or you can answer that concurrently.
Well, the state we're in is that liberalism has metastasized, as it tends to do, from being a sort of libertine or libertarian free system, more or less, into a totalitarian system of control in which no actions or thought that it can detect, particularly that it views as threatening, outside of the Overton window of liberalism, are allowed. So as has been said on the stream before, no one says, you know, this is a free country anymore. So we have to really comprehend, and this is difficult for Americans and Western Europeans, we have to comprehend that we are living in a totalitarian system now. It is no longer safe for us to speak freely to other people, because other people unwittingly or intentionally can be informers for the regime, or you could say rats if you want to put it in a dirtier way. So we need to acclimate ourselves to surviving totalitarianism in order to make it to the next stage of where our movement is hopefully going. And we can't simply, you know, like we did from 2016 to maybe 2020, sort of run around in the streets, literally, which, of course, I'm guilty of as well. We can't do that anymore. Things are very serious now, and we need to level ourselves up, so to speak, by fully, not just, it's one thing to just say this, right, but to actually act out the necessary things that one has to do when living under totalitarianism. It's critical that we do this to protect ourselves from this incredibly evil and vile system that we now live in.
And what are some of the things that people do to deny the reality of the situation? For example, I would suggest that a belief in the free market is one of them, libertarianism, individualism, but also a belief in the past. And, you know, the past has to be used quite carefully because obviously it serves as a spiritual battery. It's something that is inspiring and it's something that people can have, or they feel they can have faith in. It's something that they just love unconditionally. It's in and of itself, it's fine, it's lovely and all this. But the fact is that it is the past, isn't it? I mean, when you see these people fetishizing the British Empire, you know, and I do have fondness for the Victorian era, and I always have done, but increasingly I find myself thinking, well, look, it's not helping us in the here and now. I can understand someone thinking that it surely it will help us to hark back to our past. But it just it ends up being a sort of LARPing, especially the extent to which some people take it. It's a way to, I mean, Britain today is not an irrelevant country, but we absolutely do not rule the waves. Pakistanis rape our children on our own landmass, in our own country. So, I'll give you an example. I was talking to a boomer guy, and he was talking about this comedian called Al Murray, who apparently has this skit where he talks about all the countries that Britain defeated in war throughout the ages. Now, I can understand, you know, and Al Murray is a sort of caricature of the slightly bigoted pub landlord. But anyway, I can understand someone talking about that and even taking some pride in it. But the fact is that in this day and age, again, Pakistanis rape our girls, our 13-year-old girls, in our own towns. So what good does it do you that once upon a time Britain ruled the waves and defeated all these other countries? I think it's a form of LARPing and self-delusion that people take refuge in this past that isn't coming back anytime soon.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I should have said, it also applies to Americans. At this point, America is heading into the condition that Britain has been in since 1942 or whatever. America is no longer, it's not going to be the superpower for much longer. It's already a farcical country, and it's not the white picket fence. It's not the 50s anymore. It's not the Wild West anymore. These things are gone. And so I can understand why Americans take pride in them, but it's a misleading pride because it leads you into this idea that things will take care of themselves and that we will somehow, that we'll be back there again. And we just won't be. We will be somewhere else and it might be even better than those things, ironically. But we won't get that back again.
Yes. I was just visiting the city in Mississippi, Vicksburg, just last week, which was known as the Gibraltar of the South. It underwent a siege during the war to prevent Southern independence. And it was interesting to sort of walk through this place because you can see just how conquered and degenerated everything is. And there are some people sort of clinging on to this old idea of the past of the South. And there's like this tiny little main street, this tiny island with many closed buildings of like harking back to this era. And then the rest of it is just strip malls and black neighborhoods. And it's just a total disaster. There's even people even talk about, I went to this museum run by a based black man basically. And I go in there and he has this very anti-Confederate museum, which they told me was like well-balanced. And he actually points out, The Vice President Stevens of the Confederacy, he had a speech by basically stating the intentions of the new constitution. And this guy feels the need to point out to me how, you know, it was built on the idea of inequality and whites being superior, basically, right? Like, his entire intent with this museum is to shame white people. And the people living in the town don't even realize it. They think this guy is, like, good or something. And it's just kind of remarkable to sort of walk through this entire city of ghost dancing, basically. So I know exactly what you mean when you apply this to America as well, because the problem persists in America. Like, for all of us, this old world is just gone, and it's not coming back in any form. We can't bring it back. We don't have, you know, a lot, when, especially if you watch the commentary on, like, streams and stuff, people always say things as if we somehow have or will have political power. And the fact is, we have nothing. We can barely hop from platform to platform. We have no money. We have very few institutions. Thankfully, we have some, like Countercurrents, for example. But we're not in a position to sort of take action at this point.
Yes, and I think this is something that people find very difficult to accept and even to understand. There was an incident on my weekly show, I think in the middle of this year, where somebody asked, how do we shame young women for being sluts? And I said, and I lost my temper, because I was like, we can't. So it's a pointless question to ask. We're not in the position of some conservative father of a teenage girl in the 1950s who could rely on the whole of his community to join him in shaming her for being a slut, and thus assuring that she wouldn't be. We don't have any of the resources that that man could call upon. The church, the police, the schools, the social services, the government. None of those institutions are on our side now. So to think that we can shame her as if, and then that we can rally everyone else, that the rest of the town, to join us in doing that, is absolutely delusional.
Yeah, basically, when I hear that question, I just hear, how do we win? And I'm just like, we don't. We can't win. There is no win, right? It's, again, it's like the Japanese, you know, there were a few holdouts up until, I think, 1974 of Japanese soldiers who simply refused to stop fighting until they were formally surrendered by their commanding officer, basically. But it's like talking about winning, you know, that war as the Japanese in 1946, it's a nonsensical question, right? So when you're asked, like, how do we shame women, it's just a nonsensical question. The answer is we don't. And it's not to say, like, you can't do anything. We can do a lot of building for the future. But asking how do we win is simply not, the answer is there is no answer to that question. We can't just win, right? We can't even foresee it.
Exactly. It's like saying, how does a fat guy run the 200 meters? Well, the first thing is he has to stop being a fat guy. And that's, you know, that is possible, but it's going to take a long time. And for as long as he is a fat guy, there is no way that he is going to run the 200, well, except, you know, rather comically, going to run the 200 meters. So this is the condition that we're in. And the point is, I don't want to depress people, especially not, you know, Christmas Eve. You know, in Britain, it's now Christmas Day. And I don't want to depress people on millennial at all. You know, the whole point of millennial is to bring people together and to give them hope. But I think, and perhaps this stream should ideally have been done earlier in the set. Sorry about that, but this is the way it was. This is the way it fell together. And I dare say that most viewers will be watching it after Christmas Day anyway. I don't want to drain people of hope, but I do want them to get real. Now, this is something that, you know, I take it upon myself, and other people take it upon themselves to be ruthless in their thinking, to really look the reality in the face. I'm not saying that I always succeed in doing that, but it's something that I commit to trying to do. But then other people can look to me as a content creator for reasons for optimism, for white pills. And it's like, that's not always the, you know, I wish I could give you white pills, but it's more important that I give you the reality most of the time, I think.
Well, you know, people always tell me that this sounds blackpilling, but I don't find it depressing at all. You know, Endeavor just put out this really good video, The Moral Equivalent of War, which you should all go watch after the streams tonight. And I feel like that's kind of what we have been given with this lockdown stuff, is we now have our moral equivalent of war. We have the extremely trying conditions under which we have the opportunity to lay the foundations for a future civilization that can succeed this one. I find this exciting and fulfilling.
That's the next step that I was going to move on to. The first thing that you have to do, though, is complete this this process of accepting the situation, accepting the defeat, and accepting also that the war is now over. It's like the Japanese soldier who is still in war mode, and so he requires the rest of the world to also be in war mode so that he can continue fighting his war. But the rest of the world isn't in war mode anymore. So he's just this wacko, you know, lost in his own world. If we continue to behave as if it's 1950 or sometime between 1945 and 1950, and we can persuade everyone else to get back into war mode, we're just going to look crazy. And I think that kind of has been the position of conservatives ever since 1945. That those people who, well, actually not obviously not conservatives, but those people who perceived that something had gone wrong. The conservatives in general, I think didn't perceive that anything had gone wrong for a long time and a few decades. But anyway, that's another matter. We first have to accept the reality of the situation, and then we can start talking about the future, because all is not lost at all. But it's like this thing about generals always fight the last war, you know, at least initially when a war starts. They are still thinking in the terms of the previous war, and it takes them some time to adapt. I think that we're actually in that exact situation here, where for decades we have chosen to behave as if the last war wasn't really over. It's not really, our defeat wasn't really decisive. There's still a chance. That is delusion. The defeat was decisive, and that war is over. So you now need to think about the future.
Yes, and we have a tremendous advantage over our predecessors if we can actually realize this and therefore not take fruitless action. Trying to fight this decisively won battle is just fruitless action. You know, another example, other than looking to the past, would be, you know, I see a lot of people putting hope in, say, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, as, you know, maybe he could win in 2024 and protect us all from the, you know, the coronavirus lockdown regime, or maybe Florida can remain a safe haven. I mean, this guy is just like Trump. I mean, there's pictures of him. I saw Gab posted a picture of him going to touch the wall in Israel, as you do, right? This guy has been in the Republican Party all his life. I mean, we need to get out of this, like, savior complex. Like, we're gonna win just the next time if we just, like, magically vote the right ways. I mean, that's just not gonna happen, right? We have to stop putting our faith in these politicians. Even people like Zemmour in France, right? Like, would I prefer him to, like, Macron? Probably. But it's highly unlikely that we're just gonna magically elect our way out of this. Like Apostolic Majesty said on your stream, there is no political solution to this problem. The political system is a totalitarian liberal system, and that's it, right? It's like the Soviet Union was, or the Chinese Communist Party is today. There's no voting our way out of this.
What I would say, just to anyone who's getting, because there are some people getting a bit pissed off in the live chat, which is understandable. Something I would say is, The next war, by which we mean the next cultural battle, civilizational battle that secures the future trend for life in the West, that might happen in 200 years from now or 500 years from now, but it might also happen 10 years from now. I mean, I don't think that anyone winning the 2024 election will really matter a jot. I agree with you on that. But I also think that things are accelerating, and it's very difficult to predict how long we're going to be in this purgatory. It, as I say, it could be centuries, could be a thousand years, or it could be very short. Because I think the system now is very brittle. I do agree with those who have said that. I think that this transition into totalitarianism, historically, totalitarian regimes do not last long. You just mentioned the Soviet Union. How long did it last? From 1918 to 1990. That's 72 years. That's not very long. It's definitely not what you think of as a long historical epoch, a dreadful era for those who lived through it, but not something that is multiple centuries long. In the case of the West, there are some factors that could mean it would be much less than 70 years, namely the inventiveness and rebelliousness of Western people compared to Russians. Russia was largely a peasant country. The West is not largely peasant populations. And there are other factors as well. The fact that we are accustomed to far more autonomy and also material luxury than were the population of Russia in 1920. They'd always lived in penury. So there are probably many factors that I haven't listed that I couldn't even think of. But what would you say about this?
Well, yes, and what did the people in Eastern Europe and Russia do during this time? They endured. I mean, just look at a place like Poland, which was conquered by both the Germans and the Russians, and for large parts of its history, didn't even exist as a country. And Poland exists now and is one of the better places to live for some of us in the world at the moment. So, Poland was just wiped off the map, but the Polish people endured. They endured many things. The Russian people endured, and you should still care about especially your local elections. Like if, someone like Ron DeSantis can protect Floridians for, let's say, a decade while in office, that's good. And we should want to keep him in office and keep these islands safety that most likely will exist if you look for them, that we can reside in. But we can't get this idea in our head like somehow like Florida is going to rise up and like take over the whole country or something, because the regime isn't just going to allow that. But if we're lucky, small polities will allow you to live a mostly normal life within the regime.
Yeah, I agree with that. And when I say that, mentioned the possibility that this next war could take place like 10 years from now, I don't mean Florida will rise and cause this. I mean, more likely the system itself will fail. There'll be some, and I would be surprised if there isn't some catastrophic frailty within the system. But it will have to, I think it would be more likely actually to emerge from within the system than from outside it.
Yeah, and I think they will accelerate things because the people who, the internationalists who have this transhumanist obsession are getting quite old and close to death, which is the thing they fear most of all. And they also see that the power of the American empire is waning in the world, and they need that power to turn the entire world in the direction they want it to go. So the time is really running out for these people. And I think that's why you see them becoming increasingly unhinged in terms of their political policies in a very rapid succession of months, right? I mean, it's hard to even imagine how 2019 was only 2 years ago, and it was just kind of normal back then. And now we're in this Kafkaesque purgatory for who knows how long. And I think that trend will continue, and it could get really bad for a time, but it does, it feels like this will burn itself out in a historically short order. And we need to make sure we survive that burnout, because it will try to take everything down with it when it inevitably fails.
Yeah. And so what I was getting to saying was, when we say that, let's say the system will probably crumble 200 years from now, or 300 years from now. So what we need to do in the meantime is prepare so that our descendants, you know, lay the groundwork so that our descendants, so that there is something for them to rely upon when there is, when the, a chance is presented to them to take over. But the same is also true of the supposition that the system will fail 10 years from now. In fact, that makes it even more necessary that we do this groundwork now, like right now, but also continually update it so that it, so that this reactionary or whatever you would want to call it, I mean, we don't even have a word for this, and we'll get onto this problem later on. But let's just say counter-globalist paradigm, blueprint, that needs to work for the world that it is enacted in. So if it's enacted in 2030, it has to work in that world. But you can't then just let it, you know, decay, because it might be needed instead in the year 2300 or 2400, and by which time, obviously, the conditions of 2030 will be, you know, ancient. So this is, I think this is the work that, that needs to be done here, groundwork to prepare as much as possible and to keep updating it so that it works in the world of the here and now.
Yes, and, you know, especially if things end more quickly, like in 10 years, the thing we really need to watch out for, and this is why the get out of the cities rhetoric is pretty important, is you have to remember how utterly unhinged our leaders are. And I think there is a legitimate worry of nuclear war happening within the next 10 years between some set of the great powers. You know, I really do think that our leaders are that vengeful and unhinged that they would cross that line. I mean, and we know as well, of course, that mass depopulation down to like 500 million people is their agenda anyway. So they might actively want this, right? It could just be part of their plan. So, you know, it seems insane to contemplate that at this point. But I would keep that in mind in terms of where you decide to lay down roots as well.
Yeah, that is a dark thought. But yeah, when I mean, out of interest, and this is a bit of a trivial point, but I think it's perhaps useful. Out of interest, which world leaders or prominent politicians today would you suggest are, like, would you cite as the most mentally unhinged?
I feel like politicians is really the wrong word for it, because the politicians are sort of just puppets. It's hard for me to even to ascribe thoughts to their brains. I would say William Fentz or Bill Gates, right, is perhaps one of the most unhinged people. Obviously, Fauci is unhinged. Klaus Schwab, of course, is unhinged. His name has come up many, many times. People like, I wouldn't say Elon Musk is unhinged. He's an interesting person. Let's see. I'm trying to think of other people. Zuckerberg. Yes, Zuckerberg is an absolute lunatic. These people are the ones actually driving things to a significant capacity. I mean, like, the politicians are so boring now. Yes. I want to say Boris Johnson is unhinged, but it's like he's not even a real person.
No.
He doesn't even feel like a human. He's just like a shell.
I agree. He's nothing. It's interesting. And that's actually a really good demonstration of what I was saying earlier, because the center-right love to say that Boris Johnson is the Winston Churchill of our time. And yeah, he is. And he shows the deficiencies of the original Winston Churchill. He is a shill. He is a grifter. He is empty. And he uses this buffoon act to the sort of upper class eccentric thing to get by in life, I think. But ultimately, he is beholden to other powers, just like the original Winston Churchill. So it's an interesting statement on what British national bulldog spirit has actually been for at least the last 100 years. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, that it's ridiculous to have pride about Britain or England or anything like that. I'm just saying it's an interesting reflection because Boris Johnson is the Winston Churchill of our times, and Winston Churchill was the Boris Johnson of his times.
Oh, and I suppose I should. I can't believe I forgot to mention Tony Blair. That is one politician we can mention.
Oh, that guy is insane. I completely agree. He is, and I actually think the majority of the public would agree with you on that. I think he is not just despised, he is regarded as a genuinely dangerous, demonic individual.
Yeah, I watched a clip of him explaining the other day how, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he was just talking about how everyone needs to get jabbed and, there's going to be a lot of death and suffering because of this. And he was just smiling the whole time. And I was like, what the hell? Like, this guy is talking about how much suffering there's going to be. And he has this grin on his face the whole time. Like, he's enjoying it. It's absolutely creepy to see that. I mean, Kamala Harris is like this as well in the United States, although she's not as powerful as Blair. These people are just obviously insane when you look at their eyes and their...
Hillary would be another one.
Yeah. Yes, Hillary Clinton as well. I forget her because she's kind of... I think the power of the Clintons seems to be waning.
Absolutely. Yeah. But yeah. Still, she clearly was... I mean, I believe that she was mad and is mad. I believe that she absolutely would go into a nuclear war. I mean, one of my fears was that she would gain the presidency. And then if any European country started showing nationalistic tendencies, I think that she would happily... regime change that country.
Yeah, the Ukraine situation is pretty scary right now because the West is just totally unhinged and we can't even predict, and this is probably intentional on their part, we really can't predict how far they're going to go over something like this if it comes to a showdown with Russia. And I don't see Vladimir Putin backing down at any point in his political strategy in terms of dealing with the West.
Yes, indeed. And there was another one mentioned just now. Guy Verhofstadt, who's an EU, you probably don't know of him, but
no, I know him.
Yeah, yeah.
What's his current position in the EU?
I have no idea. He's in it.
Is he on the commission?
I think so. He's still a figure. He's still active for sure. But yeah, he's another one. Yes, I agree with you. I think these people are mad. They're quite mad, and in a dangerous way. Someone says to a lot of people, "We are baddies." Yeah, to a lot of people, but you and I don't trust the judgment of those people, do we? I think we know that we are quite assured that we have sanity and goodness and right on our side, and that I don't give a fuck what Tony Blair thinks about me. I think Tony Blair is Satan, so I don't give a shit about what he thinks.
Yeah, I think it's funny when they threaten us. Like, the White House put out this ridiculous message a few days ago, similar to what Tony Blair was saying, where it was like, it's going to be a winter of illness and death for the unvaccinated, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I'm not scared of you. Like, you think you can put fear in me with your scaremongering about the virus,
Yeah,
there's no reason to be afraid of these people. We should be concerned about what they are willing to do in terms of the suffering they will cause. But, don't let them put fear in your heart. There's no reason to give them that.
They're a mad animal that needs to be brought under control.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're dangerous. What I mean is they are dangerous, so we should never underestimate that. And I think that, as I've said earlier in other streams, I think that there is a danger that people underestimate the threat from Klaus Schwab because they think he's funny. They think he's the Bond villain thing, and they make that joke. He is, but that doesn't mean he's not dangerous. It means that he is very dangerous. So I think that we should take that seriously. But I also think that we should never take anything that they say on trust. We should never assume that they're speaking in good faith, because I think they almost never are.
Yes, and I mean, often you find that evil is just totally mundane, and many have observed this as well. They always tell us and have to get you to agree to what they're going to do to you, right? It's this interesting pattern when it comes to evil, is they're actually quite open about what their plans are, and they always want your consent. And you know, that is why giving in to this biomedical regime is so dangerous, because once you consent to that, it will just be the next thing and the next, and you know, who knows whether it's going to be medical or whatnot. We have to stop even implicitly giving them our consent. And there are things to fear with in emerging technological developments like virtual reality and even digital currency, right? These sorts of things. Like, you can it reminds me of the stonks thing, right? Like, a lot of people made a lot of money on like GameStop stuff, and a lot of people are making a lot of money basically gambling on cryptocurrencies. And to sort of partake in the financial speculative system in this way, even with things like NFTs, is to in some way consent to it. We have to be very careful with that, because that's how they fundamentally operate. So I just caution people when it comes to things like this to be very careful with what you are implicitly consenting to by participating in it.
Yes, I agree. Let's proceed to the second point. Ideally, I'd like to finish in about half an hour from now in order to... But we'll go a bit longer if we have to. The second point, you go for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the second point is familiar to most people, and that's this problem we have where basically every major political and cultural institution is dominated by Jews or culturally Jewish people. And thankfully, we're on Odyssey, so we can just talk about this freely here. This is an enormous problem, obviously. I think basically everyone kind of recognizes this at this point. American Krogan and Blackpilled are excellent on this. And I mostly leave it to them in terms of elucidating this issue. This is a huge problem, because no culture can tolerate a state of affairs where another nation is dominating them, right? Europeans complain about American culture dominating Europe. The same has happened to Japan. We just can't have it to where white nations are dominated, their institutions cannot be dominated by Jews, right? So this is a problem. It's difficult
I would say they can't be dominated by any non-native.
Exactly. It could be anyone. It could be anyone. It is Jews in our case. But the problem is there's been, and you know this well, there is a myopic obsession with this issue among alt-right 1.0 and to some extent on the dissident right. And we cannot think that this issue is the all-encompassing description of the problem we face, right?
Absolutely. Something that really annoys me is when people post comments sort of, they'll say something like, and who's organizing this, Woz?
You know,
have you looked into that? As if after 7 fucking years in this, I would be surprised to learn that, you know, oh, it's someone whose name ends with Berg. I wonder what the significance of that is. You know, I know, for God's sake.
Yeah, and it's like what it is, you know, the old Manosphere guys have a term for this. It's called a shit test. And we're tired of being shit tested constantly. I saw people doing this when Computing Forever came on. Like, the first chats on that stream were like, well, Dave doesn't talk about the JQ. And then he literally brought it up on stream. And I was like, it's so tiresome to have people incessantly insisting that everyone talk about this problem constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the only problem, and it's the sum of the problem, and everything has to be fitted into that narrative. when I don't think everything does fit into that narrative.
No, and, you know, the academic agent is very good on describing the makeup of our elite class and how there actually is a circulation of elites that happens, despite the fact that the ideologies often remain the same, right? We talked earlier about how the power of Clintons are waning. And I think people need to view whatever segment of the elite are these Jewish and culturally Jewish people. They are simply one faction, one very powerful faction, but one faction nonetheless, among an entire milieu of distributed, powerful organizations that have their interests, right? So we cannot ever allow ourselves to become obsessed with only one thing, be it like the Federal Reserve or Bill Gates or Jews or whatever, right? That's myopia is damaging.
It is. I mean, one thing that also annoys me is the opposite, where people downplay this matter. But they'll say things like, well, you know, Hollywood is dominated by Chinese. I mean, come on. It's absurd. I think that there is a happy medium, an accurate medium, between denying this completely or you know, slyly downplaying it, and at the other end, just obsessing with it, like it's the answer to everything, when it isn't.
Yeah, and it's, you know, one thing people need to stop doing is expecting, like, everyone to talk about this, especially on YouTube, because if you talk about this issue, it sort of puts you in a certain box outside of the Overton window, and it's actually extremely valuable to have people who aren't put there, right? Like, creators like Aaron McIntyre, for example, he has developed significant influence, and therefore this is an issue that it would be better if he simply did not talk about. There's actually no need for everyone to talk about this or any issue.
You know, I agree.
Like I mentioned, American Krogan, Devin Stack for Blackpilled, these guys are excellent on this issue. I'm not excellent on this issue, therefore I don't make videos or content on it. I recognize the issue, but it would just be stupid and pointless for every single person to be focusing on this all the time. Like it would distract us from actually achieving anything.
Yeah, and it's also a sort of fetish. It becomes like this, and it doesn't actually help you. That's the thing, because you could talk about this ad infinitum every day, every stream for 50 years, and at the end of those 50 years, they'd still be in these commanding positions, and you'd still be talking about it like hopelessly. It does not help us spiritually to constantly ruminate on the fact that a certain group has power in our society, which they shouldn't have. What helps us is to establish the principle that no foreign group should have power in our society, and certainly not power over us in our own society, and that includes them. So it includes any group. And then it also helps us to underline, to establish that we, and only we, should have power in our society, in any matter that, you know, that really matters. I mean, we should have sovereignty in our own society, just as I would expect the Jews to have sovereignty in Israel. And I would understand perfectly if they were outraged by the idea of Israel becoming less Jewish, as indeed they are. And they're not going to let some other group come in and dominate their media in Israel. Well, of course they're not, because that's a stupid thing to do. But unfortunately, it is a situation that you know, we have been inveigled into in the West.
And also note that we just discussed this issue without any reference to the 20th century or particular events in the 20th century at all, right? Like that's a big hump that still needs to be gotten over in some capacity, because this stuff is just kind of not relevant to our situation, right?
I mean, this is a difficult one, because on the one hand, it's the foundation stone for the boomers.
Mm-hmm.
They're it's key to their identity. And it's relevant in the sense that it did establish a consensus about racial identity and whatever. Although, you know, that can always be hypocritically gone against by, you know, I mean, you know, there's, but then again, even with the Jews, you know, they do marry out an awful lot. They've got a very high out marriage rate, strangely enough. Anyway, doesn't matter. The point is that that event, which you have tactfully not named, is relevant, but it is also, there is a limit to its relevance.
Yeah.
Because again, it gets us back to the same situation as that I outlined before, where you go on and on and on about something, but you don't have the power to do anything. So you're just complaining, which in turn is a sort of democratic tendency that you're hoping that if enough people hear you complaining about it, then eventually the situation will change. Well, the last 2 years have shown us that that really is not how anything happens in the real world. The things happen in the real world because the powerful choose them to happen.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it's definitely not irrelevant. It is relevant, but it's really not many cases where it actually needs to be discussed. Like, go watch American Krogan's video on the Visigoths, or series of videos, or on Bioshock, or whatever, and talk about this, right? There's no reason to focus on this one thing. And thankfully, there's less and less of this.
I'll just say this. I find it very alienating. If I go to a website or a channel, and they're going on, and like you can tell that they're just fucking obsessed with this. I generally just click away, because I think, okay, you are not of the right mindset for me. And then the other part of this is that it rests on constantly affirming how powerful an outgroup is and how weak we are in the face of their power, which I think is deeply unhealthy, because you're constantly just rehearsing your own weakness. The thing to do is, it's like a battered spouse constantly thinking how powerful the abusive spouse is. That's not good for you. You have to work on building up your own power. Which gets us back to what I just said a few minutes ago, that only by having power can you actually have influence. Until then, you are hoping for the mercy of people who have a track record of not showing you any mercy at all.
Yes, and you know, I think what people need to really ingest is that, in some sense, alt-right 1.0 got its way, because in dissident right, we've sort of fully ingested this realization, and that's sort of why you don't see people going on and on about it. And we're all a lot smarter now in how we talk about things, and we realize that alt-right 1.0 got wrecked substantially because of this exact problem, right? And, you know, I appreciate the work that people put in that time, but we've ingested that information into our sort of politosphere, and that's sort of it, right? Like there's all the content is already made on this issue. Share that if you need to, but it's not really something that needs to be harped on forever. And like you said, it's spiritually damaging to be in this state where you're constantly making out the enemy I shouldn't say the enemy, making out this group to be this ultra powerful villain who just utterly dominates you for centuries and centuries. And, oh, we're so weak. We don't want to introduce that type of thinking into our brains. We want to keep focused on what we ourselves can do positively for our people, and not harp on this problem.
I completely agree. There's a commenter saying that we were saying at the start that the situation is hopeless. We were not saying that the situation is hopeless, right? If you've taken that from what we were saying, that's not correct. The situation is not hopeless. I'll categorically say that. If I thought the situation was hopeless, I would just give up. I would stop. I would not want to give people false hope. I don't think the situation is hopeless, but I think that we do need to accept the reality. The reality of the situation, because as we outlined at the start, again, I would just suggest that you go and watch the start of the stream again. So no, I don't think the situation is hopeless. Not at all. But we, in order to have success, you first have to acknowledge the reality that you're dealing with. Okay, so is there any more you want to say about this?
No, I think I've said my piece on the issue. Like, we don't need to harp on it.
All right. So we'll move on to the third thing, which is basically the failings of neo-reactionary philosophy. So that's a very interesting thing. So please take it away.
Yeah, so I think it's pretty clear to everyone at this point that there are serious problems with things that Mencius Moldbug / Curtis Yarvin puts forth, particularly things like his model of the cathedral. Like, at this point, it's kind of obvious that there's top-down coordination happening in a very direct way across the governments of the world. And it's hard to say, as your UK column guests pointed out, it's very difficult to say how high the structure goes and who is really in charge. But we do know that it's organizations like the United Nations, the EU, the World Economic Forum, the Federal Reserve, etc. The International Bank of Settlements, I think, was at the top of their hierarchy. And so we can kind of see this happening in front of us. And I think that's why a lot of people have sort of moved past sticking to the neo-reactionary model of the cathedral, per se. Now, I do think that his model is still important and useful at describing how the lower levels of the apparatus of the ruling elite operates. So the way the journalists and Harvard and random leftists essentially coordinate is actually because they have this shared religion of progressivism in their heads that allows them to spontaneously agree on basically everything. So the model is still highly relevant there. And I'm not saying that Moldbug / Yarvin doesn't still have good points every now and then and useful posts on his blog, but I think his utility is waning. And, you know, we can kind of see that his sort of fully decentralized or distributed model, and those two are actually an important distinction. This model doesn't really work when you scale it all the way up to the top, right? It's really clear at this point that there is...
Let's just be clear about what you're saying here. Mm-hmm. This notion of a decentralized cloud of influencers who don't really have an ideology, they're just going by a consensus. You're saying that works at many levels of management and organization, but it doesn't work at the very top level.
Yeah, like it's not that they don't have an ideology or consensus. They do have that. But that to me only seems to explain the sort of spontaneous agreement between media institutions and universities. But in terms of, for example, the lockdowns are really the critical thing. It doesn't seem to me that this sort of came out of some sort of spontaneous process of progressivism. It's very obviously planned in 2019. We even have videos on this at this point. It's very obviously planned by the ruling elite at this point. They knew about this thing breaking out, whatever it is. They knew it was going to break out of the lab, assuming that's where it came from beforehand. They had this plan in place. This is actually a good example of the circulation of the elites happening, because it's clear that like the government of the UK, for example, had no idea what to do in response to this thing initially. And then the Gates Foundation came in, circulated in. And I think now this is part of the circulation of the elite. I think the Gates Foundation, who had this plan, this top-down plan for society, has now, to a large extent, implemented it and essentially become the new ruling elite, right? So, and this is a top-down phenomenon. That there's no like spontaneous evolution or progression of ideas between universities and media. This is the Gates Foundation intended for decades, at least a decade, to implement the totalitarian system we have now and extend it even further. And I think that is just clearly elucidated by everything we've seen happen over the last several years, and also statements and intentions that have existed in the past from Gates and his foundation, right? So we need to just recognize that at this point. But again, that's not to, to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, okay, well, we can't ever, you know, reference Moldbug again. We can't ever reference the cathedral. These ideas have their utility, but they do not, just like the previous topic, they don't adequately describe the full scope of the problem.
So would you say at some level that, I mean, maybe I've got this wrong, but my understanding was that at many levels, from immediately above us to very high up, it is largely driven by consensus, sort of unconscious, almost self-governing in that way. But then at the top level, it's much more conscious. Because I would say that it has to be. And this is the thing that people took it. There's a blogger called, Eugippius.
Yeah, I know him.
Yeah. Who did this controversial article a few weeks ago where he said that it's not a conspiracy. It's not directed from the top. It's a decentralized decision-making cloud of many managers, and none of them knows there's not an intent here. It's not a conscious plan. It's just sort of happened almost by accident. And a lot of people really took exception to that. And I thought I took exception to it. I thought, mm-hmm. Come on. Like, something like the last 2 years does not happen by accident. You're not going to tell me that they just sort of accidentally or subconsciously hit on the idea of a digital ID and a global digital currency. I mean, come on. And then all the stuff to support that. No, that it has to have been directed from above.
Yeah, oops, we just accidentally totalitarianismed or something. I mean, you know, again, to an extent, like there are organic processes that happen, but there is a circulation of the elite. There are multiple elite groups, and there, you know, there's no ultimate like one guy or one secret group at the top. I think, you know, I do think there's a sort of distribution of powerful interests and organizations that mostly have the same ideology but are competing for power, right? So there can be a circulation in here. And like I said, the Gates Foundation clearly circulated in with their plan and implemented it. And in that sense, this is a top-down plan. It's not organic. The governments of the world, the British government, had no answer to the coronavirus, really. They had no idea what to do. And the Gates Foundation walked in with this decade-long plan they've been working on. Here's our vaccination program, etc. This is what we're going to do. Digital enforcement, yada, yada, yada. And now they have their way, right? So, you know, I don't want to get to be, I'm not saying like the Illuminati or like controlling everything. No, there are multiple interest groups, but they are making plans, right? It's not like an organic ideological process that's just sort of happening in the universities or something, right? This didn't come out of the universities and media complex. This came out of the true ruling elite, at least one of their groups.
Yes, it came out of people who were looking to redesign the world. They didn't just accidentally redesign the world. They were looking to do it. They were consciously planning how to do it. And then they trickled orders down into the cloud of decentralized NPC managers that constitute our politicians today.
Right, and I think we have to recognize, too, if Eugippius was mentioning like the managerial revolution, like the managerial revolution happened a long time ago, right? So we're in another revolution now, right? So what we don't want to do is, this is sort of similar to what we started out with, what we started talking about with, is that we don't want to just like take this managerial revolution and apply it to now, because, you know, Burnham very intelligently saw the managerial revolution happening and wrote about it extensively in the midst of it, but that's not the revolution that's happening now. It's a different one with different interest groups and characteristics. And we can use what we have learned from Burnham and other writers to understand it better. But what we don't want to do is fall into the trap of thinking that this is just more managerialism. It's something else entirely.
Yeah, I agree. So is there anything else? You know, you did mention, you said this group circulate at the top level. The obvious fact that there is some tightly coordinated group of persons who are directing the course of civilization, I would say world events, at the highest levels. This group circulates like any elite, and those in circulation are from several groups, including powerful Jews, capitalists, communists, and ideologues of other types. We cannot at any one time say exactly who it is, but this force is clearly visible through its effects. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Yes, well, this is sort of just an elaboration of the specific groups that we can say are holding the reins of power, right? Like, there are still many capitalists who just want to make tons of money, and they're not really interested in the transhumanist stuff. The transhumanists seem to be in charge right now, where, you know, they're trying to turn society into this weird, you know, metaverse NHS civilization. but there are other interests too. There are legitimate socialists who would like to bring about that revolution. There are the green ideologues, right, who are interested in climate change and saving the world, and they clearly have some influence now, but that's a different influence than these other groups. Again, Jews have their own interests in terms of culture and what they want to do with civilization. Even the Chinese, right? The Chinese are another powerful group that have significant power in the West at this point, simply by buying out our economies, right? And they're a competing interest group. So there are these several groups in the ruling elite and none of them intend anything good for us. And their actions seem to mostly be in the same direction. They're in the same degenerative direction in different forms, right? So if we see, for example, if we see that the biomedical security state deteriorates into something else, that could be a signal that the Gates group has waned and some other group is now more in play than they are. Not that the Gates Foundation would ever totally go out the window, right? But there are multiple interests. What I just want to hone in on here is it's not like there's some smoke-filled room of the ultimate powerful, you know, people who are deciding everything. There is competition between these powerful interests that diverge in some ways and converge and cooperate in many others. Obviously, what's happening in the biomedical security state serves the interests of the capitalist class. What's happening at the Federal Reserve with the massive inflation we see serves the capitalist class. And it's being used to back the interest of people like Klaus Schwab as well, which is a different interest, right? Like, these people Klaus Schwab really does want to change the world, right? He is not a guy who just wants to make a ton of money. He wants to implement his vision of the world. And this is facilitated by the financial machinations of the Federal Reserve, which facilitates other interests. You know, again, I mentioned like the capitalist, right? So we always have to keep in mind these multiple competing interests. It's not really something that we have the power to leverage because these people are just so high above us that, you know, as we mentioned, we don't have the power to do anything, but we need to be thinking about the people running our society in this way so that we can hopefully make better predictions about the future.
Yeah, I was just posting that link in the chat to that essay which I sent to you earlier.
Hmm.
Because it ponders this notion of multiple competing groups within at the highest level who have different interests, but obviously their interests coincide to a great extent, but it will change over time. Okay, so let's summarize this. The first, because this, I think this has been a bit of a troublesome stream for some people, understandably, and that's why I do think we should have done it earlier on, but that's my fault. Okay, something to, for me to bear in mind in future. So number one, the regime has achieved total victory over the West, and we should accept that reality so that we can deal with it instead of LARPing and operating from a position of delusion. Two, the JQ is relevant, but it is not totally relevant. It's not the explanation for everything. And one other point I'd make about that is, what I was saying earlier about when someone sort of dares you to acknowledge it as if, and then acts as if they have hit upon this forbidden secret knowledge that has eluded most other people. Look, it just is not like that. So stop thinking that you've hit upon the panacea, like the answer to everything, that somehow other people haven't heard of it. Because it's like people sort of fetishize this because they know how controversial it is. So they feel like they're holding a lump of kryptonite in their hand that can just destroy any social consensus. And unfortunately, it is not like that for several different reasons. Anyway, but I do, of course, the JQ is relevant. But its relevance is not as absolute as some people want it to be. Now, someone did say that I've forgotten, there was a comment about it being a sort of, it's like the end point for low IQ edgelords. That is also true, I think. Which is, again, that's not to say that that's not to diminish its importance, just to say, yeah, it's not absolute. And then third, neo-reactionary philosophy, the idea of the cathedral as a self-governing, subconscious, self-perpetuating system of unthinking consensus. That is a bit of a... It's like wishful thinking in a sense, isn't it? It's like they would like it if there were nobody in charge, really. And someone made a really good comment about the character Worth in Cube, which was a film from 1997, I think. And this character says that there is no one in charge. There is no ultimate authority. Big Brother is not watching you. And that's the most terrifying thing of all. Mm. And, you know, I think in 1997, that would have seemed quite a sort of original thought, I guess. But it's also a very 90s thought. It's a very nihilistic, hey, dude, nothing really matters, dude. No one's in charge, dude, kind of idea. And I think the last 2 years should have dispelled that notion. I think that Big Brother is watching you. This thing about the cathedral is only relevant up to a point. After a certain point, there has to be a conscious, a number of conscious decision-making people whose eyes are fully open about the reality on the ground and what they want to do, how they want to change that reality.
Yes, and this is not to say that Moldbug, especially his old blog, does not remain a very good part of the pipeline to introduce people to the dissident right. Absolutely, you should still use that open letter if you think it relevant, if you're trying to introduce people to these ideas. It's just that for those of us who have, you know, been doing this for years now, we need to realize that the need to advance beyond that. There's a level beyond that. And we can then say that, okay, these ideas that Moldbug puts forth are relevant to this extent, but no further. And, you know, I think a large part of his problem is Moldbug has an experience as being part of the elite, right? But he was part of like the State Department elite and the university elite, but I think that's given him a false idea of how the ruling class actually operates, because I think the level that he was at was far beneath people like Klaus Schwab, etc. And I think because of his own life experience, he developed this powerful yet incomplete model of what the ruling elite are truly like. So I think that's where these flaws come from, which is fine, right? Like, everyone has their flaws and blind spots. And again, his work is still excellent in many regards and worth sharing with people if it's appropriate to those persons. Oh, also, before I forget, since you mentioned dystopia, I'm flabbergasted that you have not seen the movie Brazil. And you must watch this film because it is perhaps the best depiction of the Kafkaesque dystopia we find ourselves in.
I think what I'll do next year is try to adopt a habit where I watch one film a week, and I just force myself to, you know, put down my work for 90 minutes or 2 hours and watch a film. I've just completely got out of the habit of watching films for a long time, like 20 years. And I think it shows, because I get 90s film references, but I don't get references to, you know, more recent films. And also, as other people have mentioned, that there are gaps in, like, very significant gaps in my knowledge of films going further back. I still haven't seen The Godfather. I haven't seen any of The Godfather. I haven't seen Close Encounters. There are multiple films, many films. That if I were a regular cinema, you know, cineast, I would be watching these things. I would have seen them. So it is a problem. But anyway, that's a different issue altogether. So, but next year, I think I will try to do that, to hopefully alleviate that problem somewhat. Anyway, Charlemagne, are there any final things you'd like to say?
Well, I would say, I think point one is the most important thing. If there's anything to take away from this stream, it is that we must acknowledge the state of affairs as it is, which is that liberal totalitarianism has won. It has conquered us. But this does not mean there's not hope. It's not a black pill. There is plenty of great work. We have our moral equivalent of war now, that in which we will construct and survive through new institutions and relationships and friendships that we can build, families we can create. So if there's anything to take away from the stream, it is that we must be more realistic about how we are simply at the complete mercy of the regime right now. And God help us with that. And yet there is still light we can cling to, and islands of hope, like this very millennial, right? We're still here. We're still working. We're not going to commit ourselves to the last war, though. We must acknowledge the defeat in the last war and work on putting our descendants, maybe even us, if we're very lucky, in a position to win the next one for all of Western civilization.
Yes, I agree. I've just remembered that there are questions. So, okay.
Oh, my favorite. I love super chats.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Leon Dell says, Woz, what are your predictions for 2022 regarding global governance, national sovereignty, individual liberty, etc.? Thank you. And he donates a significant amount, so thank you for that. I would say I think we should expect a continuation of all of these trends that we're seeing. Global governance will continue to work its way and, you know, develop and spread. National sovereignty, I think, will continue to be corroded from both within and without, because I think the national politicians have given up at this point. I don't think they care anymore. And I think they're quite happy for it just to be a meaningless sideshow, where they can pretend to be important and, you know, all that. They can have pointless falling outs that don't really have any consequences. I think the politics at the national level, the political cultures of each country, are now populated by people who are optimized for that kind of low-grade bickering and meaningless one-upmanship and just pointless. Well, point scoring. that's the kind of behavior that they're naturally tending towards. Meantime, those who are optimized for actual power are gravitating away from the national governments towards those centres. So I think that will continue to happen. And then individual liberty, I think, well, let's just, all I can say is I think we need to hope for the best there. I really do hope, for example, I hope that lawfare is an avenue that we can explore in the future. Obviously, the courts are beholden to the governments, who are beholden to international institutions, including big tech, as we've seen in Ireland. But the courts are still, you know, the judiciary is still an area where ostensibly there is still national sovereignty, law, tradition, precedence. And it would be very obvious. The judiciary is an area where it would be very obvious that the nation was being corroded. If a legal precedent were to be violated or something like that, or to be ignored, that would be an act that would be very obvious to everyone. So I suspect that there is room for using lawfare against these international institutions, just because for it not to work out would be such an egregious violation of tradition and the way that people still think the world is organized. You know, people still think that national law means something, and therefore it has to mean something. Otherwise, people will be alarmed. Now, that's not to say that, well, the masses will wake up, but it would be a problem that would have to be explained away. And it would be a discrepancy that would have to be explained away. So I think that's something that I would want to, that I hope dissidents of all stripes are able to explore in the future. But of course, it does rely on legal funding. So that's what I would say about individual liberty, national sovereignty, global governance. It might be that at this point in the story, that will be entering the third year of COVID and the Great Reset and lockdowns and so on. The digital ID might be coming in. It might well be that at this point in the story, the organs and individuals involved in global governance start to get high on their own importance and their own success and start to make mistakes. Or it might be that they start to get high and start to get arrogant and more unhinged than they've already been. I'm not sure. It might also be that this is the stage at which their plans start to become unwieldy and start to fall apart. I'm not sure. But definitely I think that the innate tendency of global governance, as is the tendency of any form of governance, really, other than a completely sickly one, is to pull more and more power towards itself. So I think these institutions are bound to do the same thing. The WHO, the WEF, NATO, the UN, not the EU so much, because I think it's already spiritually dead. But yeah, so there we go. That's what I would say to that question. Now, there are quite a lot of questions for you. Gus Faze says, I remember being black-pilled and not caring about the 2016 election. Then the Trump thing happened. But that turned out to be a disappointment. But it was an opportunity that came out of the blue. How should we handle the next Trump moment?
Ooh, well, if it's a literal Trump moment, I mean, I think one of the worst things that could happen is if Trump wins the 2024 election. I mean, at this point, we just need to not hook ourselves to any Trump train-like thing. All this national politics stuff is just a total waste of our energy. Take a lesson from like the tactics of the Napoleonic Wars and think about the concentration of force, right? If there's something that you can achieve in a local or state level, that's worth doing. But I think these presidential elections are way too easy to get caught up in to a degree that's just not helpful. In this case, you actually do need to clear pill yourself and fully disenchant yourself from the sort of interest, right? The machine, just like it generates interest in like the film propaganda it puts out. It wants you to distract yourselves with these show elections, but they're not worth your time.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think the trick is not to get too excited, you know, get excited for current election and all that. try to avoid that, because it is a way ultimately for them to keep us under control, as they did with 2016 and 2020. Okay, here's to 7 years of beating our heads against the wall. Share and like, you glorious warriors. Well, look, I don't want us to be beating our heads against the wall, anything but, you know, I want everything we do to be worthwhile and to build towards the future. And that means being clear-sighted. And unfortunately, that means acknowledging things that we might not want to acknowledge, things that we don't want to be true. But, you know, like those leaders at the very top of society, we have to acknowledge the reality as it is and not as we would like it to be. Okay, this is Gus Fays again. Personally, I love the guests that get everyone riled up. We need that upheaval. We need to keep leveling up. Yeah, I agree. And I think it's probably something that millennials will be known for in the future. As much as it will be known for bringing people together and digesting the ideas of the year and the events of the year, I want it also to be a place where people discover things that they might not have discovered otherwise. And some of those things will annoy them. But, you know, if I think that they are good ideas, then I will make them available to people on Millennial. Winter Phoenix Forest, Karen, has posted a bunch of quotations from something about a character called Roland. And I don't think we have time for me to read them out. So, and I don't know what they're from, so it would take up time. This is Lady of Shalott. Just wanted to wish Charlemagne and his family a healthy, happy Christmas. I always enjoy his contributions on Academic Agents Channel and everywhere else. Millennial 2021 continues to be outstanding. Happy Christmas, Woz, and everyone in the chat. Well, thank you very much, Lady of Shalott. It's very nice, kind words.
Yes, Merry Christmas. Lady of Shalott is a wonderful lady, if there ever was one.
Okay. Chain Reaction says, that's it, that we dare to give a crap. No mind. Merry Christmas, brothers and sisters. I'm not sure what he's referring to there, but thank you nonetheless. He says that he was, Brazil came on TV. Yes, okay, that's nice. I'm glad that you and your girlfriend were distracted and that the film is good enough to do that. Excellent. I'll make sure to watch it. Someone else says, agreed, watch Brazil and one film per week, New Year's resolution. Yes, possibly. Okay, and I tipped you with dollars. I know you want crypto. I'm not technologically gifted, ready, but want to support. Thank you. I'm so thankful for Millennial and all of the perspectives shared this year. Authenticity is the new wealth, in my view, and it's strong in this community. Cheers. Warm days ahead. That's from Treehouse. Thank you very much. Those are kind words. And then, Woz, utilizing the website Letterboxd may encourage others to watch and discuss films as well. It's extremely woke and we may all get banned like everywhere else, but it may be worth a shot. Well, I've never heard of Letterboxd, but I will bear that in mind and forward that to my to-do list. Thank you very much. Okay, I think that's it. So let me just refresh Entropy. Yes, that's it. All right. Thank you very much, Charlemagne. This has been a very interesting stream. It's opened up three new avenues for people to explore and contemplate. I would ask people to entertain these ideas and to do so from a position of calm. I know it's annoying, and I'm sorry to sound patronizing, but I think it's necessary you know, not everything has to be decided in a state of frenzy and anger and, you know, indignation or whatever. Calm down and give these ideas the time that I believe they deserve. So Charlemagne, thank you very much for taking part in Millennial 2021. I think this has been a very special contribution.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. It's definitely an honor to be on, and I will keep in touch because we need each other in the times ahead.
Yes, indeed we do. And yeah, everyone else should remember that as well. Okay, and try not to fall out when we already agree on 95% of things. Remember that. Okay, thank you, and I will be back soon with JF Garipi. Bye-bye for now.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.